From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. In popular culture, the best homicide detectives, like Sherlock Holmes, can walk in a room, look around, and deduce who committed the crime, how they did it, and where they escaped to. Or in another story, maybe they talk to someone for a brief period of time and deduce from how they talked that they're guilty of whatever crime. It sounds like a fantasy, magical thinking, but police across America have been using something like that to put real people in real prison. It's called 911 call analysis, and it claims what someone says, how they sound, and how they act during a 911 phone call can determine if they are truly calling for help or if they're trying to cover up a crime. But is it science or pseudoscience? As our next guest puts it, this practice is spreading across police departments around the U.S., and he uses a tragic death in Decatur, Illinois, to illustrate the story. Brett Murphy is a reporter for ProPublica. He's been covering 911 phone call analysis. Brett, welcome to The 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, if you want to join our conversation, the number to do so is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. If you have questions about 911 phone call analysis as we go along. Brett, let me begin just by asking you to tell us a little bit about who was Jessica Logan. Who is Jessica Logan?
Yeah, so Jessica Logan is a young mother from Decatur, Illinois. In 2019, her youngest son, Jaden, stopped breathing in the middle of the night. And just after 3 a.m., she called 911 and told them as much. And our story kind of follows her case from that moment up to her trial and afterwards.
Yeah, and we can delve into some of those details, yeah. But can I just ask you to begin, what do we know about what happened to her youngest son in those early morning hours of October 7th? You mentioned he stopped breathing.
Yeah, that's what we know. We know he died. We know he died that night. He was 19 months old. It seems pretty clear from the pathologist who did the autopsy report, as well as the outside pathologist that I consulted with, that he died by asphyxia, most likely. He stopped breathing. And that is sort of the extent of what's undisputed. There's sort of two versions about how that came to happen. One is the police and prosecution's version, which was that Jessica had killed him. The other was the family's explanation, that he stopped breathing by accident, that he likely got tangled up in the sheets. She had said from the beginning and kind of throughout the whole case that she had found him face down, tangled up in the Paw Patrol sheets. So those were the two sort of narratives of what went down.
Yeah, and you report that he had also had a history of illnesses and breathing problems for multiple doctor visits and hospital visits.
He did, yeah. So since he was born, Jaden had been in and out of the hospital and doctor's visits at least two dozen times. He'd been admitted, I believe, at least four times. The diagnoses, or had been treated for RSV at one point, pneumonia, bronchiolitis. So he did have a documented history of respiratory illness.
All right, so you mentioned there's these two versions of what happened. One is, yep, it was an accident. The other is it was murder. And I think from reading your story, the murder narrative basically springs from this 911 call. And you shared some tape with us. I want to listen to that in a moment. But before we listen to it, talk a little bit just broadly about what is this 911 call analysis? What are its claims? What should we be listening for as we're listening to an excerpt from that call?
Sure.
You know, according to this training.
Yeah, right. So 911 call analysis is a discipline or a method that was developed by a former deputy chief in Ohio. He had studied a sample of 100 911 calls, and in those calls with some co-authors, he identified certain indicators of guilt, as he called them. These are turns of phrases, certain words, omissions, ways of speaking that if one is to take the training, which is for law enforcement only, if you take the training, you can identify these indicators of guilt and kind of mark them down as you listen. and use that to kind of predict the 911 caller's role in whatever it is they are reporting. So, for instance, if you give answers that are too short, which the detective working on Jessica's case noted that there was a lot of short answers, if you equivocate, if you repeat yourself several times, that could be seen, according to the training, as an attempt to convince the dispatcher of something. For instance, in Jessica's call, she repeatedly mentioned Jaden's breathing problems, which we were just talking about. Another one is something known as acceptance of death. That's when you say, kind of, I think so and so may be dead or may have passed away. These are all the types of things. Other ones are kind of subtle, less easy to define, something like extraneous information. What that may mean, it can be a misplaced word such as please or just in the wrong spot. You can be too polite. For instance, if you say hi at the beginning of the phone call, that could be an instance of being too polite. These are all examples of indicators of guilt.
Okay. Well, let's go to the tape. This is what Decatur police thought demonstrated Logan's guilt. And listeners, I've got to warn you, this is going to be every bit as unpleasant as you imagine listening to something like this might be. But I do think it's crucial context for what we're talking about. What you're about to hear came after the dispatcher had asked Logan for her address and name and phone number. Then she asked what's wrong. Logan said her son has breathing problems. She went in to give him a treatment and found the boy's body stiff and cold.
Jessica, take a deep breath for me, okay?
I can't. There's no safety.
I know. I know.
Baby.
Like I said, we've got everybody on their way, okay? Do you think, Jessica, listen to me. Do you think he is beyond any help?
What? I don't know.
Okay.
He's not going on.
Okay, Jessica, listen to me, okay? Do you think that we can help him, or do you think he is beyond any help?
Don't know. I think he's probably on the way to this.
Okay, I'm sorry. I can't understand you.
I don't know. I think he's gone. He
You
might.
think he's, you think he's gone?
He's still golden arm.
What?
He's still golden arm.
He's hard? Okay. Okay. I'm sending someone to assist you, okay? Please leave everything as you found it. Is there anybody I can call for you?
Brett, what did Decatur police make of that call?
So there were a few things in there that were indicators of guilt, according to the lead detective on the case. He had learned these indicators by taking that training I was mentioning. He had taken it months earlier, and he was kind of noting them as he was listening. One of the ones that I forgot to mention before is it's called a not an explicit plea for help. So you heard there that she said, I need my baby. According to the training, if you're not explicitly saying something like, I need help for my baby, that could be an indicator of guilt. So because she omitted that turn of phrase, that's an indicator of guilt. She said, I think he's gone. I think he's all the way gone. That's that acceptance of death I was telling you about. It could be perceived also that she was, quote, resisting the dispatcher because the dispatcher had to ask questions multiple times. These are all indicators of guilt. I think he found multiple throughout the call that were kind of just like that.
Does this analysis make variances for the different ways humans react to traumatic circumstances?
So that was sort of the first question I had for most folks as I was reporting this. I was speaking with experts, linguists, statisticians, psychologists, asking that very question. Is it one, is it possible on its face to analyze a call for these sorts of indicators, given all the things you just said, how an individual may react to trauma or acute shock, how they express themselves. And because of all the different reasons why we are unique as people, all the different demographics, education, upbringing, dialects, all these things, geography. It's very difficult to do. It's very difficult to prescribe what someone should or shouldn't say in an emergency or just in general. That's what the experts told me. So on its face, a lot of the folks who do study this type of thing, even those who study deception detection, had a difficulty kind of believing it. And likewise, there were kind of a battery of studies after that initial one to try to replicate the original findings to see if those indicators of guilt I've been telling you about did in fact correlate with, quote, guilty callers, and they have been unable to replicate almost all of them in each study. So according to the research and according to the experts, the answer to your question is no. It's not quite as easy as this training would make it out to be.
I guess, you know, from a common sense standpoint, one imagines that even somebody who's like an air traffic controller in Chicago, right, who's used to dealing with high stress situations and keeping calm in them, might behave differently, you know, if their child was lying dead in their arms or dead in bed.
You know, a lot of people mentioned examples just like that. There are folks who just react to stimuli kind of deadpan or very calmly, whereas others will be more hysterical, and there's, you know, there's a million different reasons for that. Jessica Logan, you know, I was reporting on her quite a bit throughout this story to try to get a better sense of who she was. And a lot of the folks closest to her, you know, her family and friends told me that, you know, she has a very specific way of speaking. She can have a flat affect in, you know, some moments, not so much in others. And it's kind of hard to get a read on her a lot of the times. And you know, she was also diagnosed with a pretty severe learning disability. And that, you know, that could have factored in as well. A lot of the folks I talked to also mentioned that, you know, folks who might be neurodivergent would have different ways of speaking as well. And they may have a harder time kind of passing the that spectrum of guilty indicators when they make a call too. So there's a lot of things that go into how a person would sound on a 911 call.
Just a few minutes and then we need to take a break. But let's talk just about the baseline for this case. Is it common, or I guess maybe I should say not uncommon, for the deaths of very young children to make challenging cases for police and coroners?
Yeah, so it is. A lot of the times, you know, if it's an infant, baby, toddler, there may not be a lot of physical evidence differentiating between an accident or a homicide. And, you know, there are cases like this, people, you know, children Jaden's age who die of undetermined causes every year, you know, hundreds. So it can be really difficult a lot of the times. And that's kind of where we found that this training operates. It operates in that space where there may not be a lot of other physical evidence. There may not be a lot of witnesses. And this is marketed as a tool for law enforcement to use to kind of bridge that gap.
And again, this is something that you said subsequent research was not able to validate, this 911 call analysis. But it's widespread, right? And this training is actually certified by the state of Illinois and local police training boards here?
Yeah, we found it. So we, you know, on your first question there on how widespread it is, it certainly is. We've found cases like this all over the country. The training has taken place in police departments, prosecutors' offices, coroner's offices, training academies all over the country. It's been used in cases sort of, you know, the range all the way from just being part of a police investigation all the way into, you know, making its way into actual trials. And it's been certified, accredited, funded by different state, local and state agencies, hosted by them. So sort of legitimized in a lot of ways by those outside agencies, which was the case in Illinois too.
All right, if you're just joining us, we are talking with Brett Murphy, who's a reporter with ProPublica, about his story looking at 911 call analysis, which is a police technique. It's a technique that there's not a lot of evidence for. In fact, attempts to replicate what evidence there is were unsuccessful. But it has been used to put a lot of real people in prison, including a woman named Jessica Logan from Decatur, Illinois, whose youngest son, Jaden, died in the early morning hours of October 7th, 2019. We're talking about that case and Brett Murphy's story for ProPublica on this phenomenon. And we're going to continue this conversation when we come back. If you want to join us, the number to call is 800-222-9455. We're going to be talking about this for about another 10 minutes or so on the show. You can also tweet us at 21st Show, at 21ST Show. If you have questions about 911 phone call analysis, we want to hear from you. Again, the number to call is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We're going to talk more about 911 call analysis in Jessica Logan's case when we return with reporter Brett Murphy from ProPublica. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with reporter Brett Murphy from ProPublica about his story on 911 call analysis and how it's being used across the country. Police listen to 911 calls, and based on this training they've had, supposedly they can determine indicators of guilt, how the person talks, what they say, how compliant or responsive they are to the 911 dispatcher, can tell police, according to this training, whether somebody is likely guilty of a crime or not. The problem is evidence attempting to validate and replicate the findings of this training have been unsuccessful. So the question where this piece is exploring and that we're exploring today, is this science or is it pseudoscience? And all this, Murphy framed his story around a case out of Decatur of a woman named Jessica Logan, whose son Jaden died in 2019. It seems Logan was not really aware of how investigations work, and officers on the case maybe took advantage of this. You shared with us another audio clip of when police work with Logan to reenact the night her baby died. Let's listen to that.
Can you go ahead and stand up and show me from there what happened after that?
I saw that he was cold and hard. Mm-hmm. I kind of, ran into the room and got my phone, and I called 911 and told them that my baby wasn't breathing, and they hurried up and got here.
Okay, so you picked him up, you realized
yeah.
He was cold and hard.
And I was holding him the whole time, just crying and screaming.
Okay.
All right, and then you also sent us a clip from Logan's interrogation with police. Let's listen to that as well.
Irrefutable proof that something happened to this kid and that you did something to him, okay? You killed Jaden.
No, I
yes,
did not.
You did kill Jaden.
No, I
and
did
I'm
not.
Going to listen to me. I'm going to be able to prove it, all right? Now, it's up to you whether you want people to think that you're a cold-blooded murderer and that you just tossed your son aside like he was nothing, or it's also up to you to show that that's not the case, that you did something to your son and you're regretful for it, and you're remorseful for it, okay? I'm not seeing any remorse, I'm not seeing any regret.
Brett, can you talk about the ways in which the 911 call analysis seemed to inform everything that came in the investigation after that point?
Yeah, and I think that's a good word, Brian, inform. So the kind of throughout the investigation, there were notes made by both the lead detective, child services investigators, other officers who were on the scene that day. The lead detective was not. And after the analysis, the 911 call analysis, which the lead detective performed on the first day he was assigned the case. That's when people started making notes, you know, officials involved with the case started making notes of Jessica's emotions. They were insincere, crocodile tears. She was sad in certain moments, not in others. Those sort of observations are throughout the case file, and they also appeared at court. So I think what happened here is that, there was sort of a read that was made on her after the call analysis, and then it just appeared at various really important turns of the investigation, the prosecution, and then again at the conviction, and all the way to the point where, you know, local media was also kind of criticizing her for not being, you know, emotional enough at certain points of the trial as well.
And maybe we should remind listeners what you said that her family said about her affect and how she presents to the world.
Yeah, so she has a learning disability. She can have a flat affect in certain moments. She takes a while to connect thoughts a lot of the times, takes kind of long pauses. You get to know these things about her if you spend some time speaking with her, as I have in meeting with her. Her family has known these things for a long time. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's just the way she speaks, it's just the way she is. And if you watch those videos or listen to some of the, you know, the audio clips in the story, I would hope that readers would come, to have a better understanding of her as well, because I think that's sort of important to, as you were saying earlier, to who the person is making that 911 call.
Yeah. All right, let's get a caller. And Jim from Champaign is on line 4. Jim, thanks for calling.
Good morning. This is Jim from Champaign. I am stunned by the manifest unwillingness to extend Jessica Logan the honest benefit of the doubt, manifest really in both clips, and I'm disgusted by the readiness and willingness to lead the witness, notably in the second clip.
All right, Jim, thanks. Do you have what do you think of this 911 call analysis? Do you find it potentially convincing?
Well, I'm wondering what incentive the police have to find everyone guilty.
All right, Jim, thanks for that. Brett, I wonder if you have any response to what the caller said there.
Yeah, well, I think so. You know, a 911 call has no doubt a lot of value to investigators, right? It's the first statement that people will make in a case a lot of the time. Sometimes it's the only statement. You can set a timeline. You can compare facts that you discover later in the case to things that were said earlier in the phone call. And I think a lot of the times, according to the experts in law enforcement I talk to, I think a lot of the times there's, you know, a hunch or a gut feeling that you have as an investigator, and the experts warn that you can be looking to validate that hunch pretty early. And if there's something that's purporting, you know, a scientific basis or research that can help you do that, I think that's sort of the answer to Jim's question a lot of the times. And the experts I was talking to warned that will reinforce some confirmation bias. You'll just be looking for those guilty indicators.
I wonder if, you know, the way the accent somebody has, if they're from a racial or ethnic group or something like that, if that plays into the, you know, if that can play into this analysis.
That's also been a concern of those I talked to as well. You know, the experts and the researchers I spoke with were really concerned about that, about dialects. You know, Jessica Logan has a drawl. Some people have different dialects, people from different ethnic groups, parts of the country, geographies. And as far as I could tell in the research, the original research that was the foundation for the training, those things were not factored in. Most of the calls, 2/3 of the calls in the original study all came from Ohio. So that, you know, you can see on its face, and a lot of the statisticians I spoke with said that that's not going to be representative of, you know, say a caller from, you know, the Navajo reservation or somewhere in the deep south.
Sure.
So it's important to, you know, factor that stuff in.
Yeah. Only about a minute left in our conversation. I understand that this is just the first in at least two, if not more, stories. Where's your work going next?
So next we're going to be exploring sort of the origins of the program itself, the agencies, local, state, and federal, that have helped spread it, as well as those in the justice system, all the way from the prosecutors to judges themselves who have kind of given it the stamp of approval.
And super briefly about Jessica Logan, her case, I understand she lost an appeal. Is it still working its way through the courts?
It is, yeah. So that decision is currently being appealed to the state Supreme Court. And then there's another avenue for what's called a post-conviction appeal in addition to that as well. So there are still several court proceedings going on in the case.
All right. Well, I want to thank Brett Murphy from ProPublica for being with us today on the 21st show and sharing your reporting with us.
Brian, thanks so much for having me.
It's really a great story, I should say, as well. People should seek it out. The headline is after her baby died in the night, a young mother called 911. And then basically it's how Jessica Logan's call for help became evidence against her. You can find that. We'll have a link to that on our website, 21stshow.org.